Hebrews chapter 11 then, and first of all, verses 1 to 3, and then moving to verse 8. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for, and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. Verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Verse 13. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. What do you think faith is? It's a word we do bandy around, but do we really know what we mean by it? For some people, faith is little more than optimism, a looking on the bright side. God's in his heaven and all's right with the world, they say, smilingly. For some people, faith is just fatalism, an acceptance of the inevitable. It is the will of God, they say, resignedly. For still other people, faith is just orthodoxy, a rather superstitious recital of the creed every Sunday, with a nod in the direction of the altar, perhaps. And for still other people, I think we have to say faith is just credulity, a mindless exercise in wishful thinking. What is faith? Well, as I say, over the next three Sunday mornings, we're going to try to answer that question by looking at three different passages from the New Testament. And we begin this morning with what I think you could justifiably regard as the classic text on the matter, Hebrews chapter 11. These words were originally written to a group of Jewish converts who, under pressure of Roman persecution, were in danger of abandoning Christianity and reverting to Judaism. Throughout the letter, the author has used just about every device at his disposal to try to dissuade them from such an act of apostasy. He's exhorted them, he's warned them, he's instructed them, he's reminded them. Don't throw away your confidence, we find him saying at the end of chapter 10 in verse 35. Don't throw away your faith, as we might put it. You need to persevere. We are not those who shrink back, who return to the old ways. We belong to the company who believe and are saved, he says. Well, here in chapter 11, he's pursuing that same goal of pastoral persuasion. Perhaps he feels his previous arguments have left them unconvinced, or his previous rhetoric has left them unmoved. Well, he has one trump card still in his hand to play. And in chapter 11, he plays it. You see, nobody in the first century of our era was immune to the appeal of heroic example. Greek and Roman culture, which dominated Europe in those days, was saturated with hero worship. It was a cult. Their ancient mythology celebrated the exploits of Ulysses and Odysseus. Recent history recounted the deeds of Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar. Wherever you looked in the first century world, you saw statues. Statues of soldiers, statues of athletes, statues of philosophers, statues of orators. Every one of them revered for the fame they had achieved. So there was nothing more desirable to the Hellenistic mind than to go down in history as one who had won the praise and admiration of your fellow men. It was their civilization, of course, that gave us the very word hero. And these first century Jews, to whom this letter is written, though resilient in many ways to Greek and Roman cultural influences, had not escaped this tide. Unwilling to be outdone by pagan talk of Perseus and Hercules and the like, Jews in the first century and just before had compiled catalogues of their own heroes too. One of the best known has come down to us in a book called Ecclesiasticus, not to be confused with the Bible book Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiasticus was written around 200 BC by a Jew called Joshua ben Sirach. And though it's not part of the canonical scriptures, the Bible, chapter 44 of his work is really quite well known. It's an edifying reading suitable for school speech days, and I strongly suspect some of you have heard it. "Come, let us sing the praise of famous men," he begins, "the heroes of our nation's history." Ben Sirach goes on to list the kings and the sages, the prophets and the legislators, the poets and the composers who had contributed to Israel's greatness. Their line will endure forever, he concludes. Their fame will never be blotted out. Well, these Jews to whom Hebrews is written, I think quite certainly were familiar with those lines from Ecclesiasticus. And here in chapter 11, not without a touch of literary genius of his own, I think, our author exploits this to his own advantage. Look, he's saying to them, if you renege on your Christian confession, you are betraying the memory of all those great figures of Bible history whom you celebrate and who have gone before you. One by one, he selects some of those leading characters from the Old Testament scriptures. In each case, you'll see, as you cast your eye down the chapter, he paints a little cameo of them. And yet, in the end, he has so many miniatures of this sort suitable for display in his portrait gallery, he's embarrassed for lack of space. Verse 32, he tells us he has to place quite a dozen of them or more on reserve. "What more shall I say?" he says. "I do not have time to tell you about Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets." But in all this vast variety of experience and personality, of circumstance and achievement, which comprise this list of heroes which they represent, there is, he says, one feature that is common to them all, one attribute every single one of these spiritual giants of the past possessed. It's faith. As he says in verse 2, faith is what the ancients were commended for. It's because of their faith that these men of old received the divine approval, he says. And if you want to be their worthy heirs, you must demonstrate the same quality. Now, this morning, we don't have time to look in detail at any of the pictures hanging in this hall of fame that our author has constructed for us. What I do want us to do, though, is to focus our minds just around those first three verses, the words of introduction that, as it were, form the preface to the catalogue of his art gallery. For in them, he provides us with a very interesting and important definition of faith. And I think that definition will help us quite a bit in our pursuit of an answer to this question we're considering these three Sundays. So what is faith? Look at them again. "Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible." So he tells us faith is a state of assurance about certain important things. You notice he uses two words to describe this inner conviction of faith, which our version renders a little simplistically, I think, being sure and being certain in verse 1. Faith is being sure, faith is being certain. I don't like either translation there, because it seems to me to imply that faith is about feeling 100% certain. The believer is sure, the believer is certain. That suggests our translator. And that isn't really the thrust of these original words. Indeed, it could be a very misleading interpretation of them. Because if you look at them carefully, I think you'll see that what defines faith in this chapter, and even in these opening words, is not its degree of psychological certainty. What defines faith is the kind of realities which faith feels sure about. That's the distinctive thing about faith. Faith, he says, is first and foremost the ability to see the invisible. A bit like Superman, you see. Faith has X-ray vision. It pierces beyond the realm of the temporal and the material. The things faith apprehends may be invisible, he says, on the first hand, because they are spiritual as opposed to physical realities, what he calls here things we do not see. Or they may be invisible because they are future rather than present realities, what he calls here things we hope for. But either way, faith is able to perceive that which to ordinary sight is unobservable. And in this way, he says, faith is sure of what we hope for, or more literally, gives substance to, or provides support for those things we hope for. In addition, he says, it is certain of what we don't see, or more literally, it provides evidence for, it convinces us about those realities that lie beyond the horizon of our physical senses. I say again, to have faith in this way is not necessarily to feel 100% certain about these invisible things. It's possible to doubt the intuition that faith provides, just as indeed it's possible sometimes to doubt the evidence of your own eyes. But faith, whether it does so weakly or strongly, detects these invisible things, and it informs our mind of their existence. Take the universe, for instance, says our author. When unbelief looks at the universe with just its five physical senses to guide it, what does it see? It sees a fortuitous accident. It sees a network of physical systems generated by blind chance and random chaos. But he says when faith looks at that same world, but with this sixth sense of faith to inform it, faith sees a creation. Not just a big bang, but a big person. It sees the ordered, deliberate handiwork of God. By faith, we understand the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. There is an invisible world lying behind the world of physical sense. Now, neither unbelief nor faith, I suggest you, necessarily experience 100% certainty in these rival interpretations of theirs. You talk to an unbeliever, you will find that there is much that contradicts his atheistic worldview, and he's not unaware of it. Maybe he looks at the exquisite mathematical symmetry that governs elementary particles, which modern physics has disclosed. Or maybe he looks at the extraordinary molecular complexity of the living cell, which modern biology has disclosed. Could it be there is a divine intelligence that is responsible for this mysterious cosmic design, he asks himself? And thus he doubts. He doubts his atheism. He's not 100% certain, atheist though he is. And if we're honest, we have to confess that the believer too observes things which are emotionally compelling and which seem to count against his worldview too. The suffering of the innocent, the exploitation of the poor, natural disasters, the victory of violence. John Stuart Mill, in a very famous essay 150 years ago, argued that the observation of evil in the world necessarily places a question mark against any naive suggestion that this world resembles the work of an almighty and loving God. So we're not talking about cast iron psychological certainty here. Ask any Christian and they will tell you they too experience doubt. I think it's important to point that out because some people, of course, won't become Christians until they feel 100% certain. Well, if you're waiting for 100% certainty before you become a Christian, you'll wait forever. In fact, if you're waiting for 100% certainty, you'll never even send that Valentine's card tomorrow, will you? Now, what we're talking about here is not 100% certainty. We're talking about the personal commitment which in spite of the ambiguities in the world that we observe as we look at it through our five senses, nevertheless affirms the reality of those intangible, invisible things to which the sixth sense, intuition of faith, bears testimony. What makes faith difficult, I suspect, for many, many people in our modern world is precisely that. Western culture has brainwashed us for two or three centuries with the assumption that that visible things are the only real things, that only those things that can be detected in one way or another through our five physical senses are real, believable. Seeing is believing, we say, don't we? Well, frankly, our author here begs to differ. On the contrary, he says, seeing is not believing. It would be much closer to the truth to say believing is seeing. See, a rationalist world, dominated with science and belief in experiment and logic, has wanted to convince itself that it can fully understand everything just on the basis of that evidence. Rational, empirical, scientific evidence and proof. If it can't be proven or demonstrated that way, it's not to be accepted. Well, faith laughs at such intellectual prejudice. No, it says, by faith we understand. Rationalism has it the wrong way round. See the order. It isn't reason that informs faith. It is rather, he says, faith that informs reason. By faith we understand. Great theologian of the medieval church expressed it in a Latin tag, credo ut intelligam, I believe in order to understand. Pascal, the French philosopher, put it perhaps a little more accessibly when he says, the heart has its reasons which reason cannot know. There is an intuition about faith which can't be reduced to rationalistic explanations. The things faith perceives are not demonstrated or demonstrable by rationalistic logic. You can't prove the existence of God like Pythagoras' theorem or Archimedes' principle. It is pointless to try. For God is the source of all observed phenomena, and therefore can never become a deduction. Everything else is a consequence. Even the rationality that we use to think logically is his creation. It derives from him. So to try and prove the existence of God scientifically is a bit like trying to prove the existence of sight by examining your own eyeball. It can't be done. Reason, of course, is a very powerful thing, but it is a tool. It's a tool that requires raw data to work upon. Raw sense data, the scientists would say. But faith, like a sixth sense, informs reason. It feeds its perceptions of those unseen things into our reasoning minds, just as our eyes channel images of visible things into our minds. So says our author, by faith we understand. That's what faith is. The ability to see the invisible. It's for that reason, of course, the unbeliever is not likened in the Bible to a poor philosopher or a faulty logician who can't work out a theorem. In the Bible, the unbeliever is very often likened to the fool who will not take notice of what is staring him in the face. If it is ignorance of invisible things that the unbeliever is suffering from, the Bible insists it is a culpable ignorance, an ignorance born of that philosopher's own blinkered assumptions about things. Like Nelson, he puts his scientific telescope to his blind eye and complains he sees no God. The man or woman of faith refuses to deny those intuitive perceptions of the unseen, non-material, future things. They have both eyes open, physical and spiritual, if you like, and such binocular vision renders the sort of skepticism to which the rationalist is prone inconceivable. No, by faith, we understand, it is glaringly obvious, that the universe was formed at God's command. You'll often hear atheistic people these days, scientific atheist people, telling you that rationalism has really delivered the modern world from religious superstition. The mathematician Laplace famously told Napoleon, when Napoleon asked him where God figured in his mechanics, "Sire," he says, "I have no need of that hypothesis." That's the attitude that we've grown up in. Scientific humanists insist that science and rationalism has made us come of age. We've passed beyond the infantile fairy tales of religion. We're now in touch with the adult realities of science. So modern men and women don't need mythological God language any longer to explain things. So we're told, and one has to say that it's one explanation of what's happened to our culture. But there is an alternative explanation, isn't there? And one, I think, which our author here has a lot more sympathy with. Could it be that, in fact, what's happened in the last couple of hundred years is that our technocratic, urbanized culture has atrophied a spiritual faculty, a faculty of spiritual perception, which is, in fact, really natural to us? So that Western men and women are increasingly incapable, without a great deal of deconditioning, of seeing things which are as plain as a pike staff to our ancestors, and which are still glaringly obvious to a larger part of the world's population. Our passage, I think, suggests two pieces of evidence in support of that interpretation of things. First of all, suggests our author, it is surely a matter of mere anthropology that belief in a world beyond the visible world, beyond the world of physical sense, has distinguished the human race from its earliest origins. Whether you regard Abel and Enoch, talked about in verses 4 and 5 here, as being real historical figures or not, I'm not going to argue about this morning. But what you certainly can't deny is that religious consciousness goes back that far, to the very dawn of human civilization. This is one of the things that distinguishes us most clearly from the beasts. The highest apes are without it, and the most primitive of mankind possess it. So isn't it arguable that modern atheism, far from being a step forward in our human progress, is actually a repression, a tragic retrogression behind the condition of even our primeval infancy? Is it possible that rationalism has performed a kind of psychic lobotomy, that it's surgically severed our spiritual optic nerve, so that we cannot see what is in fact glaringly obvious to just about every other human type of human being that's ever lived on the earth? That there is an invisible spiritual reality behind our physical world. The other piece of evidence that seems to me that our passage suggests is this. If our author is right when he says that it's by faith we understand, not the other way around, then it is surely to be expected that without faith, we shall not understand. And that, I suggest to you, is exactly the fate of modern Western men and women. Rationalism has not emancipated us from bondage to superstition at all. It has plunged us into an unprecedented abyss of meaninglessness. Never in the history of the world, I think, has so much philosophy of despair been written as in our 20th century. And it's all a reaction to the reductionism of rationalism that wants to say the only things you can believe in are the things you can touch and prove. Our universe is not self-explanatory. The meaning of our universe does not lie within it. So scientific rationalism is always going to be a dead end. What you finish up with is not an understanding of the universe at all. what you finish up with is a huge cosmic question mark. An accidental universe that by random chance has thrown up this monstrous anomaly we call a human being. What are we to make of it? Rationalistic science has given us no help at all. It's only made the mystery 10 times, 100 times more intense than it was before we started thinking that way. The world is not more intelligible to 20th century people than it was to previous generations. It's more perplexing than ever. Isn't it possible then to ask whether this rationalist worldview that insists it's only the things that you can touch or prove through your 5 senses, which you can believe, isn't it reasonable to ask whether that rationalist worldview that leads to such empty, nihilist conclusions may not be grievously in error? That's certainly the view of our passage here, you see. Our author insists, no, by faith we understand. If we will not accept the intuitions and perceptions of faith, we will not understand ourselves or our world. Faith provides uniquely a coherent framework for making sense of our existence. And in so doing, he says, it provides us with a whole new way of living in the world. A way of living that has purpose and direction and significance. As I say, we haven't got time to study in detail this chapter, but just cast your eye down to that one character we picked out in our earlier reading, Abraham, in verse 8. Just observe the kind of life which faith gave to him. Just notice the way it enriched his experience. First of all, because this man was a man of faith, says that author, his life was full of adventure. When called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, he obeyed and went, even though he didn't know where he was going. For faith, you see, laying hold of unseen realities, is always willing to leave behind the familiar. It's never hidebound by tradition, never nostalgic about the past. It never has to clutch its Linus blanket of security. The future excites faith. His life was full of surprises too. If you look on to verse 11, he had a baby at a very odd time in his life. But faith is never defeatist either. Never paralyzed by past disappointments, never surrenders to self-pity. Against all the odds, faith is always expecting God to do the unexpected because it lays hold of those invisible things that God has in store. And if you look on to verse 17, you'll see Abraham's life wasn't without its adversities, without its trials. There was a time when he had to face up to the possibility of losing his beloved son, Isaac. But even there, faith makes possible a new way of responding. Faith doesn't need to hold on to things, be they precious children or precious possessions. For faith's treasure is in heaven. Its hope lies in the future. Faith's chief reward always lies in the future. Like Abraham, we look for a city, says our author. His courage then, his enterprise, his sacrifice, these are all born of the vision of these invisible things above and beyond this present world, which Abraham by faith embraced. Do you notice the odd thing our author says about Abraham and others like him in verse 16? They were longing for a better country, a heavenly one, he says. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God. It's an odd thing to say, isn't it? God is not ashamed to be called their God. Almost as if God could be embarrassed by us. But that seems to be what the author's implying, doesn't it? Haven't you ever noticed how parents at a school play cringe with embarrassment when their child fluffs his or her lines? Other parents may be chuckling with amusement, but not the parents of the child concerned. They are immersed in blushes. Why? Well, it's because there's a special relationship there, isn't there? That's my child. So, says the author, there is between God and men and women of faith. In the absence of faith, we haven't even got to first base in a relationship with God. For as he says in verse 6, without faith it's impossible to please God. Anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. A person without faith has neither reason nor incentive to live a life which is God-centered, which reckons on those invisible things. But once our spiritual eyes are opened to the invisible world, once, like Abraham, we have embarked on this pilgrimage of faith, with all its adventure and its surprises, and yes, sometimes its adversities and its sacrifices too. Once we're embarked on that pilgrimage, God becomes emotionally involved with us in a way he never was before, says Arthur. He looks down from heaven as those parents look at the school stage. And if we begin to fluff our lines, if, as these Jews to whom he's writing in this letter to the Hebrews were inclined to be, if we begin to think longingly of the world of unbelief we've left behind, if we begin to flirt with the thought of escaping the hardship and the struggle of faith's journey and returning to our Linus blanket of security in unbelief again, why then, says our author, God is embarrassed by us, feels ashamed of us. Now, he says, those saints of the Old Testament, they sustained their commitment. That's why they were heroes. They kept their spiritual vision focused on that better country, which is a heavenly one. And God was proud of them. He was not ashamed to be called their God. And he won't be ashamed to be called our God either. Do you feel like a hero? I certainly don't. But then I'm not sure Abraham felt like a hero, you know? And are we really to imagine that when he embarked on that journey, leaving Ur of the Chaldees because some impression of faith had told him God had something great for him in the future, but he had to get out of this pagan city to find it? Are we to imagine that he was 100% certain as he stepped out, not knowing where he was going? I can't believe he was. But the point is, he did embark. Unbelief would not have dared. But faith convinced Abraham sufficiently of those invisible things to enable him to make a personal commitment to this unseen God who was calling him into discipleship. But dare I ask whether faith is summoning you to such a commitment? I don't ask, are you 100% certain? You'll never be that. But has faith conveyed to your heart sufficient conviction about the reality of God, about the reality of a world beyond this one, of the importance of the unseen future which lies in God's hands, and of the significance of Jesus, his son, that you're willing, like Abraham, to step out in faith? Faith begins with the ability to see the invisible, but it can't stop there. Come back next week, and you'll see faith is also about believing the promise and obeying the word. Let's pray together.